Today's programming is made possible in part by Jeff and Ann Clark, in loving memory of their son, Todd Clark.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our online and broadcast Main Street all across North Dakota. History is the reflection of scholars who, after digging into the past, find ways to share their discoveries with people who have not done that research. And over time, history retold might shed details and morph into something not altogether true. Consider the American Revolution, which to the British was a colonial insurrection. Donald Johnson is an assistant professor of history at NDSU and the author of Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. It looks at our formative conflict from the perspective of the colonists under military rule. Johnson's book won this year's Distinguished Book Prize in U.S. History from the Society for Military History, and we thought that distinction warranted an encore of a conversation with him that aired last October. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Why did you write the book?
So I was originally searching, it was when I was in graduate school about 10 years ago, searching around for a seminar paper. And it was in the midst of kind of one of the worst periods of the American occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I had been studying the American Revolution, and it got me thinking that there were vast swaths of what is now the United States that were occupied by British forces during the Revolutionary War. And I hadn't yet read any good histories on how that affected the outcome of the revolution, and had an interest in what historians call kind of popular politics, the effects of ordinary people and their beliefs and mobilization during the revolution. And I thought those topics kind of intersected well. So I went and did a case study of Charleston, South Carolina, and its occupation from 1780 to 1782, and found that there was a much larger story there that was connected through the six different cities that I talk about in the book, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Charleston, Savannah, Georgia, and Newport, Rhode Island. And there was just a larger story and a lot going on in these areas that historians had not studied before. So I thought it would make a really good candidate for a book project.
Well, the book is titled Occupied America. And Professor Johnson, let's just sort of set the scene here. The occupation by British forces followed years of efforts by revolutionaries to, you know, get their movement going, didn't it?
Yeah. What happened was the occupations began in almost as soon as the war started in April of 1775. And they were really preceded by what I call kind of revolutionary occupations, the overthrow of British governments in each colony, which occurred between 1774 and the early year months of 1776. And by March of 1776, when the British pull out of Boston, revolutionary control of most of the 13 colonies is mostly uncontested. The revolutionaries have done a pretty good job of both militarily and politically quelling opposition and asserting control, kind of replacing former colonial governments with new republican governments. That said, though, there are a lot of people in the colonies who don't support these new revolutionary governments, and especially in the cities, which were nodes of commerce and connection to Britain's empire, which spanned from India to Europe, West Africa, the Caribbean, and of course the North American colonies. And so for a lot of people in cities, the idea was that a return to the British Empire would be good economically, would restore their kind of social status, and it would give some stability in a turbulent kind of war. And the British kind of had that same idea. They had the idea that if they could take control of the cities in what had become the United States, what they referred to as the rebelling colonies, they could then use those as bases to kind of go out into the countryside and suppress the rebellion. And so this was really crucial to the British strategy of fighting the revolution. But what happened was that neither side kind of got what they expected. When the British entered these towns, they were kind of expecting a loyal population, a population that would support them in their war effort and make sacrifices on behalf of the king. Whereas local citizens and urban dwellers were expecting that British forces would come in and restore them back to the status quo antebellum, to this kind of prosperous period of the 1750s and 1760s, in which cities were growing at an enormous rate and connections to other parts of the empire. They were importing things and selling things all across the world. And neither of those things happened. There were economic hardships brought on by the British Army, and the British Army did not receive the fulsome support that they wanted. And so the situation deteriorated in all six cities pretty quickly after British forces arrived.
Let's talk about the nature of this conflict, because if the British had won, if they'd prevailed, this would have been like a civil war. These were all citizens of Great Britain who were at odds, one on one side of the Atlantic, the other on the other, and those colonists were not of a singular ideology, if you will. You've got all these loyalists, you've got revolutionaries, and you've got people in between walking a tightrope.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. I mean, the revolution itself, and historians are recognizing this more and more, was a civil war not only within the British Empire, but on the North American continent itself. The classic estimate for the number of loyalists, the number of patriots, and the number of what he called kind of disaffected or neutrals was made by John Adams in 1776, and he estimated that about a third of the population of British North America favored independence, and a third of the population favored sticking with the crown, and about a third of the population could kind of go either way depending on personal circumstances or which side had more strength in their particular area. And so, yeah, it definitely was a conflict that's much more nuanced and much more muddy than a lot of our popular memory of it has. You know, we have movies like The Patriot or musicals like Hamilton, which kind of give us this idea that it was heroic patriots fighting against this kind of oppressive army. When in fact, both sides kind of thought they were fighting for freedom. Both sides kind of thought they were fighting for their own liberties. For loyalists and for British soldiers, that liberty, that freedom was kind of the constitutional monarchy of Great Britain, which they viewed as the freest society ever created. And they feared that the revolutionaries would devolve into kind of demagoguery and chaos and anarchy or dictatorship. For the revolutionaries, the story is more familiar, right? It's fighting for kind of individual liberties against the monarchy of Great Britain and the unjust acts passed by the British Parliament on the colonists without their consent. And then you've got this vast amount of people kind of stuck in the middle, and these are, you know, what I like to call kind of ordinary Americans. These are shopkeepers, farmers, innkeepers, business people, you know, people who are just trying to live their lives, keep their families intact during this crisis and during the violence. And it's those stories that I think really are underserved by our histories of the revolution. But in the story of occupation, they really come to the front because, you know, one of the key narratives that happens during this period is the shift of a lot of those people, not necessarily towards revolutionary government, but away from the possibility of restored British government through their experiences under occupation.
Donald Johnson is the author of Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. And Donald, one of the more interesting aspects of the book as I was scanning it was that the historical fact that occupiers, the British, were taking advantage of disadvantaged minorities like slaves and Native Americans. Blacks were fighting with British in the colonial South. Native Americans were assisting the British on the western rural areas of the country. So this revives all kinds of issues that still prevail today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the British were not ignorant of the schisms in colonial society. In fact, they had kind of helped create some of them with their policies and governance before the war. And so one of the things they do is both to try to weaken the rebel cause and to strengthen their own efforts to restore the empire is take advantage, of some of those enmities. In terms of Native Americans, the vast majority of Native Americans, and there's been work done on this by other scholars in much more detail, but the vast majority of Native Americans, including, I believe, 4 out of the 6 Iroquois nations, as well as the Creeks and the Choctaw, who were the prominent tribe, or the Creeks and the Cherokee, were the prominent tribes in the South, all sided with the British Empire. Because they were afraid of what would happen if an independent United States existed and was unable to restrain settlers coming west over the Appalachians and into their territory. And they believed in the British ability to kind of restrict that movement and protect their ancestral lands over that of the United States. The other element, and this is, the one that is potentially, more relevant to our current situation, is that the British Army and the British government took full advantage of the existence of a large enslaved population to kind of attempt to turn colonial society on its head. And it granted enslaved people both freedom and opportunity in the British Army and in occupied territories if they fled plantations, if they came under British lines. Many of them ended up serving in the British Army, both as soldiers, but also as what in the 18th century they called pioneers, what we would think of as kind of engineers, people who dug trenches, followed the army, built roads, et cetera, et cetera. And for a lot of these people, it was a game changer, an opportunity for freedom that had never existed before. One of the stories that I share in the book is that of the enslaved carpenter Boston King. And King was born an enslaved person on a plantation in rural South Carolina. Once the British occupied Charleston, he heard of the offers of freedom that were being sent out from the British camp, kind of packs his bags and heads out to Charleston, and ends up having kind of a really interesting 2-year wartime career. He serves first as a personal servant to a British officer, which is the first gig that he ever had where he was paid for his services. He then joins up on a British privateer, so he goes to sea, and ends up at the end of the war in occupied New York City, working as a carpenter, where he then kind of reinvents his life again, becomes a leader in the free black community in New York, marries another former enslaved person, and ends up after the war immigrating to Canada, to Nova Scotia, and becoming a Methodist preacher and a leader of a loyalist settlement in Nova Scotia, which is kind of as far from a life on a South Carolina plantation as you can get. So for a lot of these people, the experience of occupation and the war could create fundamental changes in their lives, and not always for the worse. I mean, in the case of Boston King, occupation and war kind of changed his life for the better, and for historians estimate as many as 20 to 30,000 this was the case.
This also had an interesting effect, all this tumult that was happening in these port cities, and for that matter, elsewhere in the colonies, created opportunities for the dare I say it, the liberation of women.
Absolutely. There's been a great deal of interest in women during the American Revolution. And under occupation, what happened was a lot of men were politically put on the sidelines. They were considered threats potentially to the British regimes, even when they professed their loyalty, because of economic embargoes and the, like you said, the tumult of the war. They were often unable to provide for their families. And women had opportunities to kind of self-liberate, to kind of get away from under the thumb of fathers and brothers and sometimes even husbands who previously would have controlled their day-to-day lives. One of the people that I found in my research who was the most fascinating was an innkeeper in Newport, Rhode Island named Mary Almy. Almy ran an inn that had been co-run by her husband, Benjamin Almy. Benjamin volunteers for the Continental Army really early in the war in 1775. So he's gone for much of this time period. But Mary Almy becomes a loyalist when the British Army comes to Newport at the end of 1776 and occupies the town for the next 3 years. She opens her doors to British soldiers. She socializes with them. She hosts them. And she even writes this kind of series of letters, which her descendants hid for the next 75 years. They weren't discovered until the 1850s because they contained a lot of her loyalist thoughts, which are really quite fascinating. She writes to her husband basically saying that, you know, she loves him and she hopes he is safe, but she hopes that the British Army destroys the Continental Army and that the next time she sees him, he is a prisoner on parole in Newport. So they have this kind of vast political disagreement that would have been unheard of in other times.
Well, your book reminds me of the inner strife in the Franklin family, because Benjamin Franklin, one of the fathers of the Revolution, had a son, William Franklin, who was the loyalist governor of New Jersey and who ultimately worked to form units to help the British.
Yeah, and William Franklin's actually a really prominent figure in British-occupied New York for a lot of the war. He arrived kind of late. He was imprisoned by his own legislature and then held in Connecticut for the first couple years of the conflict. But yeah, once he arrives in New York in 1778, he immediately starts kind of forming these loyalist militias to go out into the countryside and the surrounding regions and plunder and kind of raid Revolutionary and Continental Army posts. So, yeah, I mean, he was an inveterate loyalist, and it really shaped Franklin's views on what became known as the loyalist question towards the end of the war, kind of when the writing was on the wall and the two sides were negotiating for peace in 1781 and 1782. Most of the negotiators, the British negotiators, kind of were demanding some concessions for loyalists who lost property or family or were damaged. And Franklin, kind of with this personal grudge against his own son, is adamant that the United States agree to no such terms, and that those who betrayed, in his eyes, kind of betrayed the cause of their country, be given no support from the government. And this is, you know, a position that ultimately isn't taken by the United States. They do agree to provide some help to loyalists, and a majority of loyalists actually end up reintegrating into the new United States after the Revolution. There's a minority, about 75,000 people, who flee, who are exiled to Canada or Great Britain or the British Caribbean. But a lot of them end up kind of making their peace with the new republic.
You talk about the economic importance of many of these loyalists, and I guess the reality is the war is over, and your last chapter in the book is Forgetting Occupation. The winners get to write the history, and it's kind of convenient to, you know, get things back to some sort of normal.
You're exactly right on the economic importance of this. I mean, one of the foremost advocates for loyalist reintegration was Alexander Hamilton, who thought in primarily economic terms. And his idea was that, yes, you know, these loyalists fought against or acted against the interests of the United States. But if we jettison them, if we exile them, we're potentially losing a massive base of capital, as well as a massive skill set. You know, a lot of these people were prominent lawyers, businessmen, politicians, people who knew, who had the skills that the United States needed to kind of build the new country. So, and in the end, the argument for kind of a lenient treatment of loyalists wins out. The thing that I observed, you know, and that I write about in the last chapter of the book is that so long as loyalists kind of were repentant or were able to kind of portray their actions as indiscretions or being kind of duped by the British, historians of the revolution in the early period were really and you know what we might call journalists writing about the revolution in the newspapers were pretty easily swayed and able to forgive them. One of the most striking things I found in reading the earliest histories of the revolution by people like David Ramsey of South Carolina and Mercy Otis Warren of Massachusetts is actually how few loyalists they actually name and how much they go out of their way to kind of excuse the loyalism of ordinary Americans. They kind of say, well, they were forced into it by force of arms or by economic circumstances or by false promises by the British. But once they saw kind of the light of day, they sided with the revolutionaries. One of the key points of this is a man called Tench Cox, who was a wealthy merchant in Philadelphia during the occupation of that city. And no man, you know, in the city could have clearly been more of a loyalist than Cox. You know, he made his money basically exploiting connections with the British Army to get trading licenses to send ships to the Caribbean and bring back and import goods. But after the war, he kind of repudiates the British cause. He writes an essay in one of the Philadelphia papers in which he calls his former loyalism kind of a youthful indiscretion. And he ends up having a quite successful political career after the war. He serves in Alexander Hamilton's Treasury Department, and then under President Jefferson, he rises to Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and writes a very influential treatise on political economy, which shapes theories in the early republic. He also serves in Congress. And it's funny, kind of whenever his loyalism is brought up, people almost treat it as an unfair attack. People almost treat it as something like, you know, well, that was the past and we all did things in the war that we're not proud of, but let's move on.
Donald Johnson is an assistant professor of history at North Dakota State University and the author of the new book out by the University of Pennsylvania Press, Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. Professor Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
We spoke with Professor Johnson last October. His book, Occupied America, received a 2021 Distinguished Book Prize from the Society for Military History. Coming up on Main Street, transgender activist Faye Seidler talks about legislating around gender after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has approved a bill that puts some time limits on teacher negotiations. The bill says by July 1st, unless agreed to be the teachers and the school board, negotiations must be completed. If no agreement is reached, the parties go to impasse. Bismarck Republican Representative Pat Heinert told the House there are several good reasons to support the bill.
The process will allow school districts to offer contracts sooner and will provide school districts a better understanding of personnel needs and, more importantly, will have the time to adequately fill any vacancies. This process will create respect and trust for teachers and school boards.
But Fargo Democratic Representative Ron Gugisberg said this bill is unnecessary. He said the issue of delayed negotiations is not a widespread problem.
The only thing that solves negotiation issues is trust, empathy, and leadership. Let's keep the onus of negotiation on our school boards and teachers and encourage leadership, not regulation.
The bill, Senate Bill 2215, passed 63-29. It now goes to Governor Burgum. The DFL-controlled Minnesota House has released details of several key budget bills. The leadership highlighted proposals for education, taxes, and labor. They say the proposals will help address the COVID-19 pandemic. Despite a budget surplus, the plan calls for increased income taxes on top earners, and that new revenue would provide a big funding boost for public schools. House Education Committee Chair Jim Davney says the spending bill for schools is critical.
One that assists teachers and provides the necessary supports our students need to catch up after a difficult year.
The tax increase proposal puts Democrats at odds with Senate Republicans, who have said all session they will oppose tax increases. And the North Dakota House has voted in favor of the state observing Juneteenth. The day is called that because on June 19, 1865, slavery officially ended in Texas, and it is observed by 47 other states. West Fargo Republican Representative Austin Schauer argued in favor.
This holiday does not include a mandatory day off for private or public employees. It is meant to bring unity to a sometimes, if not often, divided country. It is also meant to condemn human trafficking, which is a modern form of slavery where women and children are recruited with false claims, only to be exploited in the awful world of sex trafficking.
Bismarck Republican Representative Rick Becker was against the measure.
Why am I going to vote red? First off, aside from the name of it, the concern that I have is that this is more of a movement in lines with being woke, wokeness. It comes from the left.
The bill passed 70-22. It now goes to Governor Burgum's desk. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
I'm Dave Thompson. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk with Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nafee about investing legacy fund income into the state of North Dakota, also the bonding bill, and how things stand as the legislature goes to its home stretch. Legislative Review is 6:30 p.m. Friday on Prairie Public's radio service, as well as on our digital platforms.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Joined now by Faye Seidler. She is the LGBTQ plus care coordinator for Canopy Medical Clinic in Fargo, and she does policy outreach through the school systems with the Community Uplift Program, also works with an advisory board that's been known as the BU Advisory Board or the Queer Health Advisory Board. And Faye, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You testified against a proposal to limit athletic eligibility for trans students in North Dakota. Have you spoken to the bill's sponsors?
I have sent emails to them. I haven't spoken to them personally before, though.
Have they reached out to you or to advocates of your position?
As far as I know, they haven't, at least from the circles that I interact with.
Let's get into the actual bill. How would you describe House Bill 1298?
That's kind of a big question. I think that it is looking for a problem that doesn't necessarily exist, but is more based on speculation and fear, and to a point, kind of just a reaction to our changing culture.
What kind of reception did you get when you testified?
Well, I did written testimony as opposed to oral testimony or in person. So in a lot of ways, I didn't really get much response from what I've sent forward in terms of information or education or even policy research. The individuals who did eventually get in touch with me seem to be folks who already opposed to this bill for a number of reasons.
We should mention to our listeners who may or may not know that House Bill 1298 was put before a Senate committee, and the Senate decided, let's make this into a study. What's your response to the fact that a bill that would have put some limitations on the athletic options of high school students? What was your impression about the decision to make this into a study?
I think making it into a study is probably the best compromise that we can have at this point, because I think the issues presented in this bill are something definitely worth talking about, but there's so much nuance to what's going on here. There's so much potential consequence, both financially for the state as well as for athletes, either trans or cis, with potentially large consequences to them in terms of mental health or just general outcomes as youth, that we really need a lot of time to look at this to make the best informed policy decision that we can that I don't think was allotted during this legislative session. So I think making it a study and looking at, you know, what is the benefit for this? What is the consequence for it? And really analyzing that and, you know, making an informed decision is probably the best thing that we can do to say, hey, yeah, this is might be an issue, but let's actually look at it.
You have experience, obviously. You're an advocate for transgender. In September 2018, you were among several transgender citizens profiled in a New York Times opinion piece, and you shared your personal experience as a medical technician in a Fargo hospital where you were also treated. Give our listeners a sense of your experience.
I would say that over the last couple of years, I've done a lot of research into both the trans condition, the medical history of that, as well as the best policy and outcome approach from a medical lens. So beyond my personal experience with it, I just have a lot of actual on-hands experience in terms of, you know, what does the research say? What do the policies say? What does the outcome say? And that's usually what I focus on, because when we're talking about these issues, oftentimes it can be very politically charged, which I think is unfortunate because I don't see the trans condition as being political in any capacity. It's a part of human diversity, part of biodiversity. So usually when I talk about this, I don't necessarily focus on an individual experience of the condition, but rather just how does this actually play out?
How does it actually play out? What or who should determine gender? I mean, I think that's part of the issue that's in front of the legislature and that's debated, at water coolers around the country.
That's one of the interesting things here, is that if you do look at the research, and I think a problem that really happens today is that for the most part, people have just heard about the trans condition in the last 5 years, whether it be for, you know, some show they watch, whether it be with Caitlyn Jenner's very public coming out, they've just recently been introduced to it. So what they don't understand is that we have had 70 years of medical research into the trans condition in America alone. We have all of this medical research that shows that gender diversity, being trans, is part of our neural anatomy. It's part of our biology. The Endocrine Society of America did a literature review into 40 studies looking into the biological origin of the trans condition, found out that there is something there. It's not just thoughts or feelings people have like, I think it's going to rain. It's more of this innate neurological sense we have, similar to like our sense of balance or our sense of touch. It's something that is innate to us. And this is something that two really strong research articles have shown, is that, let's look at kids, for example, or youth. When a little boy would come up to you and say, hey, mom, I'm a boy, or hey, dad, I'm a boy, you just go, yeah, of course, that makes sense. That's who you are. You don't really question that. You don't really scrutinize that. But if you had someone who was assigned female at birth, who, you know, you saw as your little girl, and they said, you know, I'm a boy, suddenly there's all that scrutiny and going, well, how can you really know that? So for cis youth, or youth who identify with a sex they're assigned at birth, we don't question that. We assume that's what's supposed to happen. But with trans youth, there's always that, well, how can you know? How can you possibly know? And to kind of go back again to, you know, the research we've done on this, is that whether someone is cis or trans, so whether someone identifies the sex that they're assigned at birth or doesn't, that sense of gender identity, that sense of who they are as male or female, is just as strong in cis youth as is in trans youth. You can't like see someone's neurological makeup. You can't really just know that. But if a kid came up to you and said that they think their leg is broken, as an example, you might not be able to immediately see signs of that. You could potentially see them limping. You could potentially see them in pain, but you will take their word for it that something is wrong and something's hurting, and you will pursue, hopefully, some kind of medical treatment for that. You'll talk to a doctor, you'll get expertise opinion, and you'll kind of go from there. Maybe that means doing some kind of therapy. Maybe that means a cast. Well, the same thing is true of trans youth. There is this kind of notion out there that a kid will say, you know, I'm a girl one day, and then suddenly they are fully transitioned and getting surgeries and all that stuff. And that's not really how that plays out at all, especially within medicine. Oftentimes what happens is when you have a trans youth saying, you know, I feel like I'm actually a girl, or I feel like I'm actually a boy. Well, that's the start of a conversation. And from there, usually you look at a gender therapist. That therapist will typically work with a youth for years upon years to determine if, you know, transition is the right choice for them. And then only after they've basically ruled out every other possible thing, whether it be, you know, depression, maybe they're not fitting in that well, maybe there's anxiety, they're going to rule all those things out before they determine maybe transition is right for them. So this is a long, drawn-out process to be completely sure that these youth are ready for this. There's kind of this national idea that doctors are being pushed into this or some capacity like that, or some kind of political agenda is being played out in medicine, and that's not happening at all. And it couldn't. Like with male practice insurance, with a threat to litigation from if, you know, you forced a kid into doing trans treatment that wasn't right for them, doctors are always going to be way more cautious than they are to just plow ahead with something, especially when the national lens is so politically charged with it.
Faye Seidler is the LGBTQ plus care coordinator for Canopy Medical Clinic in Fargo and an advocate for transgender issues. Faye, last week in the Bismarck Tribune, Senator David Clemens, who's a Republican from West Fargo, was talking about this bill that we've been referring to and was quoted as saying, "Transgenderism is not natural. I don't know how anyone could ever agree to something other than that."
I think that they haven't really looked at the research, and I think they're basing it off of how they feel the world should work, as opposed to how we actually see it work. One of the things that, and to kind of give this into the more medical historical context here, is that the notion of trans being unnatural or a mental illness, that was just the common thought in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. And if you were a trans person then and you went in to see a therapist and you were assigned male at birth and you said, you know, I feel like I'm actually a woman, well, you would be presumed to be crazy. That's how they would treat you. And based on that, they would say, how do we treat this person who clearly has a mental health disorder? Well, they tried everything. They tried antipsychotics. They tried behavioral health therapy, cognitive health therapy, electroshock therapy, literally everything you could think of to cure some kind of mental health disease or disorder. And none of that actually worked out. And part of the reason it didn't work out is because it's not a mental health issue. It's not an issue of being unnatural in any capacity. It's an issue of trans individuals being who they say they are. If you look at brain scans of trans individuals, what you find is they're a part of their brain, the bed nucleus astria terminalis, which is a very dimorphic region of the brain, meaning that it is very reliably a certain size in people who identify as male and people who identify as female. You see, basically, all of the time, if a trans individual identifies as female, but they were assigned male at birth, this part of their brain shows up as female. And there's a lot you can get up to with brain science and some of it being very misleading or bad. But what we do find is that for trans individuals, they are who they say they are. They are part of biodiversity. And with developmental psychologists, with just I keep on going back to the word research, which I do all of the time here. The only treatment that has ever worked out is things like hormone therapy, things like affirming who they are. These are the only things that have had positive results. So regardless if you accept them necessarily as who they say they are, if you look at just outcomes, there is only really one direction in which outcomes are positive, and that is affirming their identity, allowing them to transition, medical intervention if they desire it. So if you're looking at just that angle, it's not unnatural. It's just naturally part of who some people are and the treatment they potentially need to pursue.
During the testimony about House Bill 1298 some time ago, it was mentioned that this is put out there as a Title IX issue, Title IX referring to the law that states that people in the United States shall not be excluded from participation based on the basis of sex. What's your response to that argument?
Well, it's kind of a convenient argument in that if you treat trans women as women, and if you treat trans girls as girls, then making policy excluding them is excluding them from Title IX protections itself. And so, I mean, That's technically what you see in the lawsuits that are rebutting states who try to propose this legislation, as it's a violation of Title IX. So it's kind of this ironic thing where it's presented as a protection of Title IX, but it's actually a violation of Title IX. But the way that they perceive it as a violation is the understanding that to allow trans women to compete is to, in some capacity, limit or erase cisgender women from competition. That to allow trans individuals to compete, they will just completely dominate the field in whatever capacity and potentially take scholarships or opportunities away from cisgender girls. Oftentimes, what we see happening is we get the two trans runners in Connecticut as this example, saying that if we allow this to happen, then we are erasing women's sports in general. And that tends to be the position, which I'm trying to accurately summarize here. What we don't see is this is a bit of a confirmation bias, because let's say that hypothetically trans girls and cis girls competed completely evenly. There's no advantage or disadvantages. Well, sometimes that means trans girls will win. Like, it would have to, even if there was no disadvantage or advantage. So when we see that happen, when we see sometimes trans girls winning, we look at that and say, oh, that is a problem. These girls are winning. But what we don't see is that there are tens of thousands of trans students. There are tens of thousands of trans athletes competing, and they're not winning. Like, they're not getting these championships. We focus on the 5 to 10 that have happened in the United States, and we see that as the biggest problem that could ever occur. But we've had these policies in NCAA for a decade now, and we're seeing so few trans athletes at the top level that to think that this is a risk is not founded. It is not a founded thing that we can see. Of course, trans individuals are sometimes going to win, and they usually do at lower divisions. But we actually see an underrepresentation of trans athletes. If things were played out fairly, we actually should see more trans individuals competing and winning. And one final thought to this is it's really weird, because this idea to separate individuals based on the sex they're assigned at birth as a way to exclude trans women from girls' sports, what ends up happening is they put trans men into girls' sports. So these are individuals who are assigned female at birth who have usually or could have gone through testosterone treatment. Basically, they'll have every advantage of any guy out there. And what we've seen is they will actually kind of do very well in these sports. There's a Texas wrestling championship individual who was a trans man. And yes, because of the legislation, they were forced to compete for female wrestling division, ended up winning the state championship. I think that's what they won twice. And the weird thing is, since people are so uneducated about what it actually is to be trans, they think that person was a trans woman because they don't quite understand the language there. But what ends up happening is you introduce an actual unfair advantage for trans men who are forced to compete against these cis women when you introduce legislation like this. So not only does it not usually impact this at all, it actually tends to hurt cis women more than it would anything else.
Well, let's talk about the challenges that transgender kids face anyway. There's a, yep, a stigma. There's a singling out that might happen to them in their school environment. There are challenges they face, and here we go with perhaps imposing another one.
So that's another interesting thing, is there's this idea that, you know, we accept trans individuals. Like, some people position their argument by starting out with that, but then say that people will abuse this policy. You'll have young boys who just pretend to be girls just so they can compete and win at a higher level. But it's such an outrageous thought to me, because of every trans girl, of the 5 to 10 who found success in the entire nation here, there's so much scrutiny and public backlash and hostility that to think someone would intentionally do that and just kind of get away is a little bit of a ludicrous thought. So that's not realistically happening, nor has it ever with any state that has had inclusive policies. But going to just the consequence for trans individuals, that is very severe. That is very steep. What we find is with social inclusion and affirmation, so accepting these trans kids for who they are, you find their suicidality drops in half. And currently their suicidality in North Dakota is around 61% of queer youth in general seriously consider suicide in North Dakota, according to our yearly risk behavior survey. This is a survey of our North Dakota students. We also found that 33% of them have attempted suicide. And another alarming statistic here is that 75% of these youth don't turn to adults when they're feeling sad, empty, hopeless, or angry. And that's because they don't trust adults to be able to understand what they're going through or even help them. So these youth are struggling so much in our state already with mental health, with anxiety, with social exclusion and stigma and hostility, and they don't have anyone to turn to. So all these problems actually are basically invisible, especially when they hear their parents talking about queer identity or trans identity and saying it's a mental illness or saying very disparaging things about it. That eliminates the support structure these youth should have, and it's making them suffer even more. So when we have bills like this, HB 1298, which is based a lot more in speculation and fear than what we see in policy, it tends to make our culture more hostile. It tends to create more of this vitriol where individuals will, you know, just talk about this like a water cooler talk, but in doing so often be very disregardive of these youth's identity to high consequence, both in suicidality and mental health. So, I mean, when we talk about these bills, they're not in isolation. They're not just something we can intellectually talk about, because there are going to be real consequences and real harm for when we are targeting such a vulnerable group.
Do you anticipate in your lifetime that we will get away from using those adjectives, cisgender or transgender, and just talk about boys and girls and men and women?
I don't think so, because they're useful categories and necessary categories. I think what will happen is we will have a better understanding of how sex and gender works. And that doesn't necessarily mean we have to get into 1,000 different labels or anything like that. We just have to understand that, at least from a medical lens and from a social lens, sex isn't a rigid binary. Like, it's a useful category. A lot of individuals will be assigned male, identify as male, have very typical male anatomy. Same thing with female, you know, assigned female, identify as female. That's going to be true for most people. But the mistake is applying that category and believing it is applied universally to everyone. With trans individuals, with intersex individuals, you're going to have people with a different genetic makeup, with a different potential hormonal makeup, with a different journey in general through how puberty goes, how a second puberty may go. And beyond just things like acceptance or being affirming to this, this is also very important in a medical lens. Because let's say you have a trans girl who transitioned, never went through a male puberty. Well, their risk factors are not going to be the same as men. Their risk factors for a lot of health conditions are going to be probably more cisnormative, probably more along the lines of a cis woman or a non-trans woman. So these categories are useful as long as we don't overextend the importance of them.
Faye Seidler is the LGBTQ plus care coordinator for Canopy Medical Clinic in Fargo, an advocate for transgender issues, and the 2020 Arc of Justice Award winner from the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition. Faye, thanks for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, and you have a great rest of your day.
Dakota Datebook is next.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
Owen Hemingway.
In order to have something new to write, he had to have something new to live.
Atop the literary world, Hemingway seeks new challenges.
I think ordinary life was anathema to him.
Reports from the front lines in Spain.
In the morning, the roaring burst of a high explosive shell wakes you.
And falls in love with Martha Gellhorn.
Martha was a woman who would not back down.
When Hemingway continues.
Watch episode 2 of Ken Burns' Hemingway tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 6th. The 1918 flu pandemic devastated the Standing Rock Indian Reservation. When the flu struck that fall, Sioux County's Board of Health closed all public meetings and gatherings. The outbreak was expected to last 2 weeks, but 48 schools remained closed for several weeks, and the 48's agency closed. The agency superintendent discontinued enrollments at the Indian boarding schools and farm school and ordered all tribal members who were camped to disperse.
A physician with the Bureau of Indian Affairs urged people to wear face masks made from thick gauze or cheesecloth when in public places. He telegraphed the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota to obtain a bacterial vaccine thought to prevent the flu, but the vaccine proved useless since influenza is caused by a virus, not bacteria. Hospitalization soared, filling the hospital in Fort Yates. A total of 42 people were treated for flu and pneumonia in 5 weeks that fall, with as many as 20 people hospitalized at one time. One woman died on her way to the hospital. The Indian school in Porcupine, North Dakota, was converted into a temporary hospital. One newspaper account reported 12 people dead in 2 weeks. Many of the dead were young people and parents to small children. Six doctors served Standing Rock. Two of them from McIntosh, South Dakota, died from the flu that fall. A McLaughlin doctor also fell ill, leaving the reservation with only three physicians in Bullhead, Cannonball, and Fort Yates. Two Selfridge women came to help care for the sick and dying. One family opened their home to the sick, and every space was filled. One Selfridge mother, whose husband and oldest child were ill, prayed that God take her newborn if one must go. The Sioux County Pioneer newspaper reported the deaths have caused sorrow and grief in many homes in every community, and it is the duty of those who have been spared to help by deeds and sympathy the bereaved. The epidemic waned after a few months, and on this date in 1919, 48 students were beginning their spring break, despite their school year having been curtailed the previous fall. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We've got plenty of home-cooked podcasts for you to subscribe to. You want to bone up on Aristotle? Then subscribe to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, hosted by UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein.
What's wrong with that argument?
Get to know the quiet, poetic grace of people, past and present, who make up our hearty region through Tom Easern's Plainsfolk essays.
Most of all, I'm thinking about that toothy fish.
And then there's the fascinating and diverse roster of guests on our daily statewide conversation convergence, Main Street. The belly laughs and fun culinary insights of Sue Balcom on Main Street Eats.
We're getting chickens, but don't tell them that, okay?
Breaking Barriers, a Red River Rainbow Seniors LGBTQ podcast. And then there's the always popular and shareable Dakota Datebook. You can subscribe to any one or all of these Prairie Public podcasts through Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, NPR One, or wherever you like to get them.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast or online stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, acclaimed Ojibwe author and scholar Anton Troyer has put together a book of questions and answers for Native and non-Native young readers, and we'll share a conversation about his book titled Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Wildfires threatened the tourist town of Medora last week. We'll talk about that close call and hear about the upcoming tourist season with Maria Miller, the new executive director of the Medora Convention and Visitors Bureau. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.